A very good morning to everyone. The first case on this morning's call is number 053481, the United States against Thomas B. Davis. Mr. King.
May it please the court. As we sit here today, we don't know why the jury convicted Dr. Davis of healthcare fraud because the indictment under which he was convicted was impermissibly duplicitous. The indictment alleged that Dr. Davis had submitted numerous claims to Medicaid, each of which was allegedly fraudulent under one of three theories. At trial, Dr. Davis submitted evidence in his defense as to each of these theories that he lacked the specific intent required by the statute. However, because of the duplicity of the indictment, it's unclear whether the jury unanimously agreed upon any one execution of the alleged scheme to defraud under any one of these theories, let alone all three.
Isn't it the case, though, that you're here on plain error review on this point?
On this point, yes, Your Honor. Although we do urge the application of the standard that is used in the Sixth Circuit of de novo review, although we do understand that the prevailing law in this circuit is
right.
Plain error.
No, you're entitled to urge, but the problem is, if we are, in fact, on plain error review, then it becomes very important for us to look at the evidence that was presented at the trial, and it does seem to be pretty overwhelming that he committed probably all three of these things.
Well, on that point, Your Honor, I believe the Kirkham case is probably the most relevant case on that issue. In Kirkham, the court held that the indictment was duplicitous, but it held that there was no error because there was substantial evidence as to all the alleged executions. However, what distinguishes this case from Kirkham had no discussion as to the evidence that was presented by the defense that may have challenged the evidence presented by the government. Here, there was evidence as to each of the three theories that the defendant lacked the specific intent, and that could be sufficient for the jury to find under one or all three of the alleged theories that there was no specific intent.
How do we know that that not personally providing the care or the examination or testing violates the language of the rule?
I'm sorry, how do we know that it does violate or does not violate?
Well, either way.
On that issue, Your Honor, the text of the regulation states that Medicaid will reimburse for mental health services that are provided by a doctor or an HSPP. It doesn't say personally anywhere in the regulation. In fact, the subparagraph 2 upon which the government relies indicates that the provision of services includes services that are not personally provided by the doctor because it allows reimbursement for the psychotherapy that is conducted by a mid-level practitioner under the guidance of an HSPP or a doctor.
Now, my understanding is the Illinois regs or rules do clearly indicate that it has to be personal providing of service.
If Your Honor is referring to the Mitrione case, I believe in our brief that's how we characterize it, although upon rereading the case, in that situation it wasn't a regulation, it was actually a provider agreement. And so it was a contractual issue. But in any event, that is true that in that circumstance, the administrator of the program sent out a manual to the providers that specifically said that the services must be personally provided, and that does not exist in this case.
There was testimony by a government expert that the Indiana rule required personal service.
That is what the expert testified to, and of course that is another error that we contend was committed. And in addition, on the issue of personal provision of services, the supplemental authority that we submitted just last week, I think, further supports the point that personal provision is not required. The regulation at issue here is Rule 20, Section 8. That section specifically incorporates Rule 25 relating to physician services, and that also uses the magic language, reimbursement for services provided by a doctor. That section goes on to state that services provided directly to a recipient by the doctor do not require prior authorization. It's clear that the OMPP, who promulgates these rules, when they wanted to refer to the personal provision of services, they did so in Rule 25. But the absence of that language from the portion of the regulation relating to testing services cannot allow an interpretation that the regulation requires personal provision of testing services.
But, you know, reading these statutes and regulations as a whole, what struck me is how carefully they do draw a line between when it's permissible to use somebody else, I'll put it that way, and what the qualifications of those other people might be. And so even if you can zero in on a couple of words or phrases, as you've done, I'm not sure on the face of it the regulations support the ambiguity you're trying to create in the word provides. And secondly, maybe we should return to the testimony of the experts, because it struck me they were talking about the way, what we might even call a mixed question of law and fact, the way that a particular regulation was understood and applied in the state of Indiana. And I'm not sure that that's out of line at all.
Well, I don't believe that the testimony was as to how the regulation was applied. The questions that the witness, specifically Catherine Bowen, was asked was, how do you interpret this provision? And she testified that she interpreted it as requiring personal provision of services.
Well, and wasn't she essentially saying, we don't approve of, we don't certify, if you will, we don't approve expenditures that are for services provided by college students?
She did not testify as to any particular instance in which that was the case. She was speaking in generalities as to her interpretation of the regulation. Going back to the first point that Your Honor made in terms of the specificity of when Medicaid would reimburse for services provided by others, the regulation, Rule 20, Section 8, has a general statement, we reimburse for services provided. Subparagraph 2 is described as a limitation upon that general right to reimbursement. And so absent Section 2, there wouldn't be a limitation on reimbursement for services that the HSPP or the doctor supervised if they were, the services were conducted by the mid-level practitioner.
But I find that very hard to imagine, to tell you the truth, because according to your argument, you know, if you even have, you know, your 12-year-old daughter providing the services, it's just fine, and Medicaid will happily pay over the money. And surely the Medicaid regulations, looking at them, where they talk about when a psychologist endorses HSPP can do things and when psychiatrists have to do them and the training for other kinds of assistance of various kinds. I just find it very hard to think that there's that big of a gap in the regulations.
Well, as to the example of a 12-year-old daughter providing the services, the state licensing regulations would prohibit that, and so therefore it wouldn't even become an issue under the Medicaid regulations. And so I don't think the danger, that the perceived danger of insufficient qualifications to perform services is covered by the licensing regulations, which, by the way, don't prohibit a properly trained technician from administering the psychological tests.
They also do cover, though, don't they, whether you need to be physically present to supervise these other people?
There are various sections depending on the context of what the service is, and there is a distinction between the administration of tests and the interpretation of tests, and they're treated differently. And here, the testimony, none of the testimony indicated that any of the technicians were responsible for interpreting tests. It all related to the administration of the tests. And in fact, the regulations allow the supervision that Your Honor referred to remotely by phone if the HSPP or the doctor happens not to be in the office.
You know, another one of your arguments, or wrapped up in your argument about the alleged duplicity, is a comment about the instructions that the district court gave to the jury. And again, I come back to the thought that this is plain error review. If anyone had said a word about this at the district court level, the government argues, well, first of all, for the indictment, they would have gone back and gotten a superseding indictment. Secondly, even if that hadn't happened, Judge Barker easily could have tailored the instructions in a way that would have said you need to find unanimously that one of these things happened. I've seen many verdict forms that are very clear about that. So again, it puts you in a weak position, I think, to argue that these mistakes at the trial level, in light of the evidence that we have here, require reversal.
Well, again, Your Honor, the point to be taken from that is that's what determines the standard of review as plain error, as opposed to the merits of whether or not it was error or not. And here, the error, I believe, is plain, that the indictment was obviously duplicitous when you look at the cases that have interpreted the healthcare fraud statute, such as Kirkham and Hickman, clearly indicate that each claim submitted to Medicaid constitutes a separate execution of the scheme. And the healthcare fraud statute is distinguished from other fraud statutes, such as mail fraud, which don't target the execution, they target the scheme itself.
So you think this should have been like a 200-count indictment? You know, every single bill that went into Medicaid was a separate offense?
In theory, that would be the outcome dictated by Hickman or Kirkham. But in this context, where there were if there were multiple claims that were submitted and all of them were factually identical in that they all had the same alleged fraud associated with them, then the error wouldn't have mattered, because if the jury found convicted as to one of those particular claims, all of them would be subject to the same result. And so in that sense, it wouldn't be required.
I don't know why. I mean, it seems to me you have an issue of the degree of generality here, and you seem willing to say that it can be a scheme for substitute billing or a scheme for overbilling or a scheme for miscoding with lots of individual instances. But if you're going to go that far, why not a scheme to defraud Medicaid?
I agree with Your Honor that the scheme is the scheme to defraud Medicaid, and the purpose is the individual executions, which the courts have defined as the individual claims.
Okay. Of course, if we'd had a special verdict, you wouldn't be having this problem, would you?
That is probably true.
And nobody objected to the general verdict?
No, they did not. And I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. We'll hear now from Ms. Jackson.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Sharon Jackson. I'm an assistant United States attorney representing the United States of America. In this case, Dr. Davis was convicted of one count of criminal health care fraud for using unlicensed, uncredentialed, uneducated college students to administer psychological and neuropsychological testing to children in the state of Indiana who were Medicaid recipients. And that clearly violated the Medicaid rule that was promulgated by the state of Indiana.
Clearly violated it?
If you look at the law and the rule, first of all,
isn't exactly clear, but
well, if you look at the entire Rule 20 that governs outpatient mental health services, I think it is clear, and for these reasons. Anytime you interpret a statute or a regulation, you first look to the plain language of it. And in the preamble paragraph and in the paragraph right before that, it says that Medicaid reimbursement is available for mental health services provided by licensed physicians, psychiatric hospitals, general hospitals, outpatient mental health facilities, and psychologists endorsed as health service providers in psychology, subject to the limitations set out in this rule. So from the very beginning, the Indiana Medicaid program has told providers in outpatient mental health services that there are going to be limitations on reimbursement for these services. And then it goes on to say that psychological testing is reimbursed when it is provided by a psychologist endorsed as an HSPP. Well, that language says then that it is to be provided by that person.
Well, there are audits of this doctor's records, and as I understand from the briefs, about a year and a half went by and nobody said anything that was wrong, right?
Well, the audit was not a full audit. They came and reviewed records and left without any findings being communicated to Dr. Davis. It's not in the record, actually it is in the record. What happened was the auditors referred it to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit for investigation, and the rebuttal witness testified to that.
Did they keep paying the claims even though that referral was made?
Yes. That is the process, to continue paying the claims.
But a year and a half later, huh?
Yes. It's unfortunate, but it does. That's what happens in the system.
Well, it's unfortunate for a lot of people. I guess taxpayers,
yes,
plus the doctor if he's guilty.
And it's particularly unfortunate for these patients that were seen by Dr. Davis, because they were children with behavioral problems, either in school or otherwise, that needed a credentialed and licensed professional to administer, score, and interpret these reports, and that
did
not happen.
So the outcome would have been different as far as their determining their medical condition, or health condition, if it had been by some other provider.
Well, we can't say that 100%. I mean, we cannot conclusively say that, but certainly that was the intent of the Indiana Medicaid program, to provide the most qualified person to provide these services to Medicaid recipients in the state of Indiana. And the rule is clear. And as Judge Woods pointed out, when they, in this particular rule, in Rule 20, when they wanted it or were going to allow it to be directed and supervised by another, they clearly said so, because they said that psychotherapy could be physician-directed or directed and supervised by an HSPP. So in the context of this one rule, when Medicaid wanted it to be supervised and allowed other credentialed people to perform services, they explicitly did too. So, so when you look at the context of the whole rule, it does become clear that Dr. Davis had to personally perform these services.
So, so is the first question we have to decide then whether whether the rule taken as a whole adopts a background rule of personal service by either the physician or the certified psychologist, et cetera, and then makes exceptions to that, or whether it begins with the background presumption that anyone can do it, and then it specifies when it's only the physician? You know, we, you can see, you know, you could start with one or the other background assumption and then deviate from it.
Well, you need to start with the assumption that only the psychologist endorsed as an HSPP could do it. I mean, that that is the language of that particular section of the rule.
Is this a question of law that we have to decide, or how does this fit in with the arguments here?
Well, this court should only consider reversal under a plain error standard, only, and not, reversal is not mandated, but only if the court concludes that Dr. Davis could personally or could delegate these tests to untrained technicians.
So if we were to decide that the proper reading, your argument anyway, is if we were to decide the proper reading of these rules in Indiana is that it was Dr. Davis's personal responsibility to administer these tests, et cetera, administer, I guess he says he was interpreting them, it's the administration that's at issue, then you, your argument is you, we couldn't find plain error.
That is absolutely correct.
What about the specific intent argument that he's making? He says he didn't know.
Well, there's ample evidence in the record. It's overwhelming evidence that he did know. In 1998, 2 years before these charges are alleged to have occurred, he hired his own expert to come in who told him that Indiana Medicaid would not reimburse when you're using college students to administer the test. His own expert told him that it was impermissible to bill in all of the ways that he did it. And what did he do? He fired that expert. He also had various provisions of the code tabbed and cut out. He had coding manuals in his office that were tabbed to sections that specifically said you cannot use unlicensed persons to perform tests and that you should not miscode. The evidence of the lack of good faith on Dr. Davis was overwhelming in this trial.
Now, it does seem that the government has inflicted problems on itself because of the way this indictment was worded. Given the fact that this is the healthcare fraud statute and not, say, mail fraud or one of the others.
Well, it is true that this indictment could have been drafted better than it was. However, under the plain air standard that we are at, it is not so poorly drafted that it affected the integrity of the proceedings below and should cause any doubt as to this conviction. There was ample and overwhelming evidence as to each of the methods of execution that were alleged in the indictment, of the miscoding, of the substitute billing, and billing when Dr. Davis was out of the country and out of the state. And the evidence was overwhelming to that. It is hard to believe, it is harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt that this jury did not render its decision and its verdict of guilty based on anything but the overwhelming evidence that was presented in this court.
Well, there's no question the billing and the coding is totally against the defendant. But you get back to the question of whether or not it's as clear as you would have us believe that personal service is required by this ordinance, because if that falls, then your verdict falls, right?
Well, it is clear to everyone who's litigating the case in the trial court. Defense counsel did not raise it. He was essentially invited to by the trial judge when he interposed his objection, and she says, I instruct on the law, and that this witness is here only to give their opinion as to how the Office of Medicaid Policy Planning was going to interpret or how it applied its rule. So defense counsel was invited to ask the court to give an instruction. All of the witnesses, and there were four different witnesses that testified that this rule meant personally provided. In fact, one was asked by defense counsel on cross-examination. They asked Special Agent David White of Health and Human Services his interpretation or how the rule was to apply it, and he said, among the others, that the psychologist had to administer, score, interpret, and write the report for psychological testing and neuropsychological testing. And so it was not a contested issue before. Everyone operated under the premise that it did require personal, and the only defense that was interjected below was whether Dr. Davis had a good faith belief.
Could you give me an example of why it has to be administered by someone who has the kind of professional requirements you're indicating? I mean, are there things about the testing that require that?
Yes. As was testified to by Dr. Sharon Bowman, who also is a psychologist, and she is the chair of the psychology board for the state of Indiana, or was at the time of the trial, testified that many parts of many of the tests that are given require a subjective assessment of how the person is responding, their level of hesitation, what mistakes they make in responding, and the nature and types of those mistakes. And that requires testing and training beyond what any of the technicians had. And in fact, the record shows that Dr. Davis abdicated all training of these technicians, or he was involved in none of the training of these technicians. He abdicated it to somebody who was not even trained himself to do it. He had the technicians merely read the manuals. Dr. Davis himself testified that he did not begin the study of psychological testing until his master's level program, and he did not begin his neuropsychological testing, which is a more complex subset of psychology, until he was obtaining his PhD. So yes, there is ample evidence that that there needed to be a certain level of expertise in the administration of these tests in order to get an accurate result. We believe that the evidence is overwhelming in this case, that Dr. Davis committed the act of healthcare fraud. We believe that the errors, if there were any below, do not rise to the level of plain error or abuse of discretion. We would waive the rest of our time unless there are further questions and ask the court to affirm the conviction and sentence in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Mr. King has how much time? You have 3 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to respond to just a few of the points that Ms. Jackson mentioned. Beginning with the last point, the testimony that Dr. Bowman gave about that some special expertise is required to administer these tests. Well, as the chair of the state psychology board, Ms. Bowman testified that even though the state legislature delegated to the state psychology board the ability to promulgate a list of restricted psychological tests that did require some sort of expertise to administer, at the time, no list had been promulgated. So her very testimony completely vitiates any requirement that there was some sort of additional expertise required.
In other words, you're claiming theoretically there are some tests that require expertise and others that any layperson could watch to make sure they're not.
The Indiana statute specifically grants authority to the state psychology board to promulgate this list of what it deemed tests it deemed important enough that there was some special expertise required. Yes, that's exactly true. Furthermore, going back to the question of whether you start with the presumption that Medicaid will reimburse for services and then there are limitations or vice versa, the language of Rule 20, Section 8 specifically says, generally, we will reimburse. These are the limitations. And then it lists the mid-level practitioner limitation in the context of the provision of psychotherapy.
But it says we will reimburse, as Ms. Jackson read, you know, if a psychiatrist, services provided by a psychiatrist, psychologist, you know, hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems to me, at least in the usual case, when there's a debate about the meaning of statutory or regulatory language, that's a question of law for the court. And if the court thinks that Judge Barker correctly interpreted this to mean personal provision unless it's okay to use some sort of assistant, then that would affect the plain error argument as well.
I believe that is an accurate statement, Your Honor, although I would also point to the principle of lenity and the fact that given the ambiguities inherent here and the specific intent requirement of the statute, that the ambiguities be resolved in the defendant's favor. As to the expert that Dr. Davis had hired, who came in and supposedly told him that substitute billing was prohibited, she also testified that that particular topic was beyond the scope of her expertise, and so her interpretation is certainly subject to question.
Before you stop, I wanted to come to one of the things that bothered me most that Dr. Davis did, which was to bill as though each test was a unit instead of by the hour, when my reading of the Medicaid regulations made it seem crystal clear that it was by the hour for those particular purposes. That struck me as abusive.
Well, I believe his testimony on that particular issue was that in the process of seeking prior authorization, he would provide to the administrator of the Medicaid program the list of tests he wants to give and request a certain number of units. It was always in terms of units, and in return, the administrator would grant a prior approval for a certain number of units. And based on that process, he understood that to mean that units meant tests as opposed to hours.
But that's not what the regulation says at all. It says per hour, and I can see the administrator perhaps in advance saying, you know, if you're telling me each one of these tests is going to consume an hour to do, I will give that certification. But in the end, if one of them took 15 minutes, I mean, when the regulation says that code says per hour, it just seems to me that's not a complex idea to get your head around.
Well, first of all, the terminology that refers to hours doesn't appear in the regulation. It appears in the CPT manual.
It's in the CPT
manual,
correct.
And
yes.
Secondly, as I said, this went to Dr. Davis's state of mind and what he believed.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Our thanks to both attorneys in the case. Mr. King, you served by appointment of the court, and you have the deep thanks of the court for your very fine efforts on behalf of your client. Indeed, the court also thanks your law firm for the amount of time and energy that was expended on this project. Thank you.